hppotcraft.com.
That was really good. Okay.
On the eve of the year 2001, a vast crowd of interested spectators were present amidst the romantic ruins of Cohen's Garage on the former site of New York to witness a fistic encounter between the two renowned champions of the strange Tory firmament, Two Gun Bob, the terror of the plains, and Knockout Bernie, the wild wolf of West Shokan. The wolf was fresh from his correspondence course in physical training, sold to him by Mr. Arthur Leeds. Before the battle, the auguries were determined by the venerated Tibetan Lama, Bil Lum Lai, who evoked the primal serpent god of Valusia and found unmistakable signs of victory for both sides. Cream puffs were inattentively vended by Vladislav of Brenrick, the partakers being treated by the official surgeons, Doctors D.H. Killer and M. Jin Brewery.
What is this amazing fight that's going to happen?
It sounds like it's going to be quite a battle.
Yeah, it sounds like an extraordinary battle that's going to happen in the future of 2001.
And end the century. That was the opening paragraph of the battle that ended the century. Manuscript found in a time machine, I believe it says.
Yes.
And that's by H.P. Lovecraft, although there's some contributions from Barlow as well.
And you are listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast at hppodcraft.com.
And who are you?
I'm Chris Lagey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
Woo!
Who are we listening to there? Who's our reader today?
Our delightful reader is none other than my son's great-grandmother, Agnes Kanon.
That's so cool. What did she think of that language she was...
She, as you heard, she did a great job of it. She read and rehearsed all of the stuff beforehand. I was very impressed with her.
Uh-huh.
Now, we're covering three stories in this one.
That's right.
She didn't really understand the battle of the end of the century.
Neither did I. We have that in common.
Exactly. And she actually thought that the next story, Collapsing Cosmoses, was really funny.
Okay.
She got the jokes of it, which I thought was interesting. But she didn't like Tilla of the Seas, which was too down for her. It was too dark. She doesn't like those dark things.
Well, of the three, that was the one that I liked the most. But we can get into that a little further along in the show. Well, that's really cool. I'm glad that she could come in and do this. I think she did a great job.
Yeah, she's outstanding. She's amazing.
I feel a little rusty right now, man. It's been a while since we've done this thing.
It's been a while. We're coming off of the amazing live show that we had in Leeds.
Yeah, we released a couple of those readings, so we didn't do shows then, and then we had the live show, which was, I had so much fun. It was such a great time. But even that seems like it was a while ago.
It was a month.
It was a successful show, I think.
Oh my God, it was totally successful. What are you talking about? It sold out.
Yeah.
Everybody loved it.
Yeah.
We had lots of people that wanted to be there that couldn't be there, so maybe in the future we'll be able to do another live show.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Maybe we'll do another one possibly in the States, as yet to be determined. It'd be nice to do again. I enjoy this experience. Maybe we'll make it a little more theatrical next time and, you know, get some more song and dance in there, which I thought was missing.
Yeah, there was no song and no dance.
A reminder that the posters from our live show, there was a limited run of these hand screen printed posters, and they're really neat. They are still available while supplies last. You can get them over at armyofcats.com. We'll put a link up to that.
Yeah.
And then when Graham runs out of them, I think, Chris, you've got some.
I've got a few here that are my own secret stash, but I'd be willing to part with a few of them maybe.
Okay, good. So if you guys are still interested, go to our site, hppodcraft.com, and you can link out from our show notes to figure out where to get that from.
Or I didn't realize until I went to the website that those things are actually hand-printed, like hand-silkscreened. They're not run off of a machine. He actually did those himself.
Yeah, all of them.
One color at a time. Totally amazing.
Yeah, he actually has a little photo album of the process. You could see how he made the posters, and it's really neat to look at.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, the cool thing is if you get one, there'll be slight imperfections in it just based on the process. So every poster that you get is unique.
Yeah.
I also wanted to mention that this coming weekend, the 17th annual H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival and Cthulhu Con will be taking over the screens of the newly renovated historic Hollywood Theater. That's the weekend of May 11th through the 13th, shortly after this show airs. This year, the Lovecraft Film Festival is sponsored by Dark Horse Comics.
Wow.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah.
And that's taking place in Portland, Oregon. And
I thought you said it was the Hollywood Theater.
It is the Hollywood Theater, but it's the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This is where the Lovecraft Film Festival has traditionally been held, although they do now do one in September in Los Angeles. But this is the old standard.
In Hollywood.
No, it is in Portland, Oregon, at the Hollywood Theater at 4122 Sandy Boulevard.
I don't understand.
Chris doesn't understand this, but most of our listeners probably will get it. If you do have the chance, or if you're already, you're probably already going, just to let everybody know, it's gonna be pretty cool. They're showing the debut of It's in the Blood, which sounds like a cool indie feature that's got Lance, our buddy Lance Henriksen in it.
Yay, Lance!
They're also gonna be doing this new interesting thing on Sunday afternoon. They're gonna be showing entries for the Lovecraft Under the Gun 72-hour film project, where teams had 72 hours to write, film, and edit a Lovecraftian short film.
Oof.
Which seems like a pretty brutal schedule, but I think the results will be pretty interesting. So go to the site to learn more. We'll put a link out to that. And I think Sean and Andrew will be there to talk Whisper in Darkness.
Oh, yeah, of course.
If you want to meet those guys. And Robert and Price is also going to be a guest.
This year, so
that'll be really cool. Brian and Gwen Callahan are running the fest this year. This is their first time running it, and we wish them the best of luck. They run Psycho Graphics. I don't know if you've ever checked out that site. They have all kinds of neat goth stuff to wear. Cool Lovecraft shirts, like a communist Pirate Cthulhu shirt, all kinds of it's really neat. We'll link out to their site. I love their stuff. So that's enough of that. Let's get into these three stories that we've got.
Well, the first story that we've got here is the battle that ended the century. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail because it's so layered in inside jokes that it doesn't really make much sense. But basically what happens is that there's this big fight that happens in 2001. One of the guys is determined the winner of the fight at the end of it, but then is called out on a technicality, so he doesn't win.
Right.
And that's pretty much it.
It's boring. When I was reading this, I felt like I was listening to teenage girls speak in their special made-up language. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, this is all in jokes for writers that know each other.
Well, yeah.
And there's a little glossary of names at the end of it, right?
Yeah. Like the Two-Gun Bob, which is Robert E. Howard. Knockout Bernie of the Wild West Shotokan is Bernard Austin Dwyer.
I like Lovecraft's name was Horsepower Hate Art.
yeah.
Hate art.
Yes, not Lovecraft, but hate art. Now, the whole thing with this story was that this idea was H.P. Lovecraft and Barlow's. This was a kind of a joke for them, mm-hmm. and what the whole plan was to. Now, this is really elaborate. They were going to write this story. They wrote this thing together. Then they were going to mimeograph a bunch of copies of it and mail copies to all of the people that are mentioned in it,
right?
People that they know. They didn't want anybody knowing that they sent it, so they sent all the mimeographs and envelopes to Washington, D.C., and then had them mailed from Washington, D.C.
That old trick.
Yes. So nobody would know who wrote it, supposedly. That was the mm-hmm. big joke that they were going to do. It seemed to work. Long made some reference, called himself Chime Sleep Short in one of his letters that he wrote to somebody, which is the name that he's given in the story.
Right.
Lovecraft goes, oh, I guess he must have gotten it and liked it if he put that in there. Mm-hmm. However, Wandry didn't like it because Wandry said, or H.P. Lovecraft says, Wandry wasn't exactly in a rage, but according to Frank Belknap Long, sent the folder to Desmond Hall with the languid comment, here's something that may interest you. It doesn't interest me.
What could he be so mad about? I mean, I think his pseudonym in here was H. Wanderer.
Yeah.
Nothing really offensive about that.
It's not offensive so much as it's just, what's the point?
Yeah, I know. I'm on his side. It was really boring. Well, I you know, if you love Lovecraft and you're interested in this whole Weird Tales group of writers, then I think it's of passing interest. But it really, that's about it.
Yeah.
One thing in here is he calls Weird Tales the Windy City Grab Bag. That's the name he gives Weird Tales in the story. Mm-hmm. And in the next story that we're going to cover, Collapsing Cosmos, there's a little through line because he does mention the Windy City Grab Bag again. So that's sort of their Barlow and Lovecraft's shared pseudonym for
exactly
the magazine. So let's hear the first little bit from Collapsing Cosmos.
Dunbar glued each of his six eyes to the lenses of the cosmoscope. His nasal tentacles were orange with fear, and his antennae buzzed hoarsely as he dictated his report to the operator behind him. "It has come," he cried. "That blur in the ether can be nothing less than a fleet from outside the space-time continuum we know. Nothing like this has ever appeared before. It must be an enemy. Give the alarm to the Intercosmic Chamber of Commerce. There's no time to lose. At this rate, they'll be upon us in less than six centuries. Hack and I must have a chance to get the fleet in action at once."
real looming threat. They'll be there in 6 centuries.
Six eyes on the lenses.
That's a great opening sentence, though.
Oh, yeah, it's great. On the cosmoscope.
Each of his six eyes to the lenses of the cosmoscope.
This whole story is, it's a joke. I mean, it's kind of a parody of the pulp science fiction stories that were sort of popular at the time.
So they are kind of doing a send-up of something? Because yeah. It feels like a bad story that somebody would have written in a sci-fi writing class.
Right. It does.
But I do like that it says at the beginning, after that first paragraph, he says, I glanced up from the Windy City grab bag, which had beguiled my inactive... So that was where the Windy City grab bag thing
yes.
came in. I like that all of these aliens have these really weird... Like it says, he was a highly developed protozoan organism from Novkos and spoke by emitting alternate waves of heat and cold. If that's a language, then my crappy shower has been speaking to me for years.
Oh.
Instead of getting so angry at it, I should just be listening.
Open your mind, Pfeiffer.
So there's lots of goofy sci-fi stuff like that and these crazy names.
And then the story is it's unfinished, but it goes on to say that Hackney, the ruler, the guy in charge, says, we've got to go to war, we've got to prepare. And then they go to get ready to do a battle, and this is how it kind of ends here.
Then, from the direction of the enemy, there came a terrifying sound, which I soon recognized as a hail and a charge. An answering thrill crept through me as I met, with uplifted antennae, this threat of battle with a monstrous intrusion upon our fair system from unknown outside abysses. At the sound, which was something like a rusty sewing machine, only more horrible, Hackney too raised his snout in defiance, radiating a masterful order to the captains of the fleet. Instantly, the huge spaceships swung into battle formation, with only 100 or 2 of them many light years out of time.
And that's the end.
That's the end. So it's unfinished.
It's just a fragment, and we kind of didn't do a great job giving you a synopsis of it, but just read it. It takes about 5 minutes.
It's short. It's only a few paragraphs.
It's 5 paragraphs of what is shaping up to be a terrible science fiction story. So I'm not even sure why it's out there. Did this ever get published anywhere?
Published in Leaves.
Oh, that was Barlow's literary magazine.
In 1938,
right?
Yeah. It didn't get published in a book until Miscellaneous Writings in 1995.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Okay.
It's remained hidden for many years, probably rightfully so.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those first these two stories that we just talked about are really for the completist, you know, for the person that just wants to read everything. I wouldn't recommend them, you know, for anybody to pick them up. And
No, we're just covering them to just make sure we do.
However, this third one, Till of the Seas, am I saying that right? Is Till
of the Seas? Yeah. Well, the title actually comes from Robert Burns' A Red Red Rose, written in 1796, and there's a quote from it, which is, "Till of the Seas, gang dry, my dear."
Which fits in with the theme of this
exactly
story.
On an eroded clifftop rested the man, gazing far across the valley. Lying thus, he could see a great distance, but in all the sere expanse there was no visible motion. Nothing stirred the dusty plain, the disintegrated sand of long, dry riverbeds, where once coursed the gushing streams of Earth's youth. There was a little greenery in this ultimate world, this final stage of mankind's prolonged presence upon the planet. For unnumbered eons, the drought and sandstorms had ravaged all the lands. The trees and bushes had given way to small, twisted shrubs that persisted long through their sturdiness, but those, in turn, perished before the onslaught of coarse grasses and stringy, tough vegetation of strange evolution.
So we're in some kind of post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah. The Earth has gotten hotter and hotter over many, many years. And they even talk about how man has actually kind of evolved a little bit to be able to deal with the heat.
Yeah. We've evolved to grow our own flip-flops.
Basically, yeah. But not fast enough. We're not evolving fast enough because the Earth is moving closer and closer to the sun.
It started at the equator, right? The sun got so hot.
Yeah.
That everybody had to kind of run away from there, and it was left to the spider and the scorpion. But people keep going closer to the poles, trying to find more temperate locales.
Mm-hmm.
And there's fewer and fewer men. And they have cities and battles. I mean, this takes place over a long period of time, this slow eradication of the planet.
Yeah.
It's a really nice setup, and I thought it was written really nicely as well.
Yeah.
It there's not a lot happening. It really is more about the description of
this. It's the description of this world and how it get, there's no characters at this point.
Well, there's the character that's introduced in that opening paragraph, but in this first section of the story, we're really just learning what had happened to get us up to that point.
Right, right. But, I mean, they don't talk about who this person is that's doing these things.
It doesn't take years or even centuries. It takes millennia, but it just keeps creeping on the sullen, inevitable, savagely devastating sun that is slowly just drying out the whole planet.
And to cope with it, they just keep migrating north and south to the poles. But it doesn't change anything.
And life has been so comfortable for humankind for so long that they don't really know how to deal with this terror, this death-like fate that's creeping upon them. It says, degradation and debauchery soon were common. Government became disorganized. The civilizations aimlessly slid back toward barbarism.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, he's describing Florida, I think. And that was mean.
Our poor Florida listeners.
There's some cities that rise up and have wars and battles and that kind of thing. Eventually they're to be destroyed as well.
Yeah.
It's almost a global warming story.
It is.
A little bit. It's like Lovecraft's inconceivable truth. It's his his take on this is what might happen if we don't.
Basically Mad Max is what it's describing.
It reminded me a little bit of, do you remember when we were kids, we had a couple of small, tiny little earthquakes in the Midwest?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was really bizarre. Nobody had ever experienced that before. And I had this friend who always had preposterous theories about things, but he was convinced that there was going to be another earthquake. And as a result of that, the Quad Cities would somehow become a tropical paradise. Which in the middle of winter sounded great, but I found it really unlikely. I couldn't understand his reasoning,
exactly.
like how
that would work. I don't know. Have you watched Road Warrior recently?
No.
Mad Max.
I was never a huge fan of those movies.
No, really? Not even Beyond the Thunderdome? You didn't like that either?
I like Tina Turner, but that was about it.
Yeah. There's a very strange thing about Road Warrior, because I loved it when I was a kid. And I've watched it as an adult, and it is a completely different experience.
How so?
Well, the bad guys in there, who I thought were very intimidating and scary, were how do I put this? They were leather clad guys that looked as if they were at the Blue Oyster Club from the Police Academy movies. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Dude has
rough trade,
exactly. Gay men that like to dress in biker gear, with lots of leather, lots of spikes.
That's what's going
rough
on trade. The
road. That is exactly what's going on in the road. I didn't understand that it was those kids. I mean, there's a guy with assless chaps. There's a dude with one guy on a leash. He's got another guy on. He's a gimp.
Yeah.
At the time, I just thought, wow, that guy's so tough that he's got a dude on a chain. But I'm like, oh, whoa, this takes on completely different context as an adult. And taking it back to the story, this is pretty much exactly what was going on in this world over the millennia.
Well, then we get that nice written setup in the first little chapter here that tells us about the dying Earth. And then we get into the second chapter.
When he had eased the dying pangs of the old woman, Ul wandered in a fearful daze out into the dazzling sands. She had been a fearsome thing, shriveled and so dry, like withered leaves. Her face had been the colour of sickly yellow grasses that rustled in the hot wind, and she was loathsomely old. But she had been a companion, someone to stammer out vague fears to talk about this incredible thing. A comrade to share one's hopes for succour from these silent other colonies beyond the mountains. He could not believe none lived elsewhere, for all was young, and not certain as are the old.
Agnes said, that line is wonderful. She was loathsomely old. She really liked that one.
She just looks awful.
She's, kind of angry that she's still alive.
But all he had known very few people in his life, this kid. And this all is the person that was talked about in the opening paragraph. It's kind of neat, actually. In the second chapter, it comes around and repeats the first couple of lines from that opening paragraph just to say, okay, and now we're back. Like, I gave you some background, and now we're back to where we were.
Right.
And Ul grew up with only knowing two women
mm-hmm.
Who he lived with in just this crappy little cabin with no civilization around. And then out of nowhere, this woman, this old woman showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Mladna.
Mladna?
And then Mladna shows up and those two women fall sick very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And those, you know, Mladna and Ull try to take care of them, but they pass away. And now it's just Ull and the stranger. He starts freaking out because he's lost these two women he grew up with. And Mladna says, hey, if you keep doing that, I'm split in two. And he said, okay, I don't want that to happen. And so he cools out and then they hang out together and gather roots to eat and go through this routine of seeking food and eating. And that's really all his childhood is just surviving.
Yeah.
But now he's 19 and he's strong. He's firm. The old woman is dead. He's on his own for the first time in his life.
Yeah. Now his goal is just to survive. He's going to try and find some water and some more food because the area that he's in now is sort of been used up.
Yeah, they're so degraded at this point that he doesn't even have cups or thermoses or anything like that to hold water where he wanted to do that. Like, they don't, there's water is so scarce, they don't even have instruments to hold it.
Yeah.
But he has heard that there are civilizations behind these hills and mountains. Mm-hmm. There's like a lost colony back there. So he wants to head out over there and see if he can at least get some fluid of some kind to escape thirst.
Yeah. If there's a colony out there, then there must be water and there must be food.
And he doesn't have any supplies to bring with him. He just takes off running over there trying to. And his estimation is I can get there in about a day. Once I get there, I'll be able to drink some water. So he's hurrying. Every time it's night, he goes. It actually says he was running at times in the warm air and at other times lapsing into a dog trot.
Hmm.
Which made me wonder, have the humans devolved a little bit so that now they run about on all fours sometimes?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't quite get that, but maybe that is what he means.
Anyway, that gets us back to where we started. Upon an eroded clifftop rests the man gazing across the valley. And he gets there. He sees, what is it? He sees like a little hut, which is encouraging. It's like a clay kind of structure. And then he runs over to it, or he goes in the open door, and
it's empty. Well, not empty. There's a dead skeleton.
Yeah.
Well, a skeleton. It's just it's not a live skeleton. Yeah.
Yes, it's a dead skeleton at the table, which is a funny image to me. A skeleton, you know, doing anything is funny. I imagine he's just, you know, sitting at the table over an empty plate, and Ull falls on the floor and he weeps.
Yeah,
as he had hoped to find somebody. There's a little break in the chapter, and then Ull, crazed by thirst, you know, he gets up, goes out into the area where this clay house is. And, you know, he has that moment where he says, I'm the last person in the world. I'm the last living person on the globe. All of Earth is mine, and all of it is equally useless to me. Because it's dried up and used up, and there's no resources anymore.
That's a great sentiment. I mean, that's just that idea. It's like, wow, the Earth is mine, but it means nothing. There's nothing that I can use. It's great. It's really neat. Idea to think about being the last guy on Earth, and then there's a certain freedom in that.
Sure.
But it's a horrible freedom.
Yeah. And I think this, I really like the story, and I like that sentiment. I think it's articulated really well. Now, in the center of this little town that he's in, Ull sees a well curb. He says, oh my gosh, there's a well. There must be some water in there. I mean, he's so thirsty.
Well, he only knew about the well from, he's never seen one before, but he's heard about wells.
Right. That's right. So he's joyful. He runs over and he leans over the edge of it and looks down, and there is water, slimy, stagnant, and shallow, but it's down there. So he goes, oh, cries out in the voice of a tortured animal. He gropes for the chain and bucket. When he does that, his hand slips, and he falls over the well curb. His chest hits it, and then he's there for a second, and then his body slides down.
Well.
And there's a little splash, and he strikes, you know, some stone that's fallen out down there.
And there's, yeah, but then there's quiet. There's no noise. There's nothing.
And now at last the earth was dead. The final pitiful survivor had perished. All the teeming billions, the slow eons, the empires and civilizations of mankind were summed up in this poor, twisted form. And how titanically meaningless it had all been. Now indeed had come an end and climax to all the efforts of humanity. How monstrous and incredible a climax in the eyes of those poor, complacent fools of the prosperous days. Not ever again would the planet know the thunderous tramping of human millions, or even the crawling of lizards and the puzz of insects. They too had gone. Now has come the reign of sapless branches and endless fields of tough grasses. Earth like its cold, imperturbable moon, was given over to silence and blackness forever. The stars whirred on. The Hold careless plan would continue for infinities unknown. This trivial end of a negligible episode mattered not to distant nebulae or to suns newborn, flourishing and dying. The race of man, too puny and momentary to have a real function or purpose, was as if it had never existed. To such a conclusion, the eons of its farcically toilsome evolution had led. But when the deadly sun's first rays darted across the valley, a light found its way to the weary face of a broken figure that lay in the slime.
That's the end.
That's the end of it. That's the end of everything.
Wow. That's...
depressing.
It's depressing, but I think it's really, really well written.
I do too. And it's certainly something to keep in mind when you're upset about how things are going in your life, you know?
Yeah, get some perspective.
Yeah, it's all going to end up with some broken guy named Ull lying in a well, so it really doesn't matter that snot came out of my nose when I laughed at that girl's joke. You know, it's insignificant.
I was talking to somebody the other day and I drooled.
Did you really?
Yeah, I couldn't believe
it. That's so humiliating.
Yeah, and of course they saw it. They saw it happen. You know, it wasn't. Yeah. They pretended like they didn't see it, but they totally saw it.
Now, did you wipe at your face or did you make a slurpy sound?
No, fortunately, when I did it, it fell forward and it didn't actually hit me. It just fell on the ground.
Okay, good.
Oh, God, it was really
embarrassing.
But
you didn't go like that?
I was just enthusiastically talking and then it was sort of like some spit that was in my mouth. But then for some reason, it was terrible. I was really embarrassed. That made me feel bad at the time, but after reading the story, I feel great.
Yeah, exactly. It really doesn't matter. I really liked that story, and I think it articulates in a more concrete way some of Lovecraft's nihilistic tendencies, you know, that we're all insignificant. I mean, this really just brings it home.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, actually, a lot of this was Barlow, and Lovecraft came in and did a little tweaking here and there, but didn't do a major overhaul like he normally does. So this is actually pretty heavily a Barlow, except for the last few paragraphs are pretty much Lovecraft. The bit that we had Agnes reading, I think, was all pretty much Lovecraft stuff. And it does sound like Lovecraft a little bit more in his voice.
It does. Most of the writing, I like Barlow's writing. I think he's got a real lyrical quality to the way he puts sentences together that's actually better than a lot of what Lovecraft does. And I could tell that Lovecraft didn't tamper too much because it was moving along too briskly. You know what I mean? It was like,
yeah,
he was getting things across, and I could have more of a sensory experience with it than having to get tangled up in the language.
Yeah. And Lovecraft liked Barlow's work as well. So you're in good company.
Yeah. Of his collaborators, I think I wish I could have seen these guys continue to work on things together. I know that Barlow was just a kid, so a lot of potential there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, Lovecraft is about to pass away, which I think had a really harsh effect on Barlow.
Yeah.
He was pretty upset about it, on top of family problems he had and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But so that's the story. And you liked it as well, right?
I did. I did as well. I think I said last week at the end of it that this was the last of the Barlow collaborations, but it's not. There's one other one that's
Night
Ocean, which people say is a good story. So I haven't read it yet.
It's actually last on our list of stories to cover, but I think we're going to pull it up a little earlier on the list, and then end with Haunter of the Dark.
We're going to finish off our coverage of Lovecraft's stories with Haunter in the Dark. And then we will do our roundup show, which is just going to be you and I talking about the show and what we've learned from it and podcasting and all that stuff. And we'll announce what our next step is with the whole podcast.
Okay. Well, next week we're going to be getting into The Disinterment, which was written by Duane Rimmel with Lovecraft. When we covered the One Tree Hill story before...
The tree on the hill.
The tree on the hill that Rimmel, that Duane had contributed to. He had written in a letter that The Disinterment was all his story, and Lovecraft maybe gave some suggestions, but wasn't very involved.
Right.
So we'll get into that and see if we believe that that's true or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there is some controversy about it.
There is.
Also, I want to bring up that coming June 2nd, I'm going to be in Manchester signing the Lovecraft Anthology Volume 2, and I'll be doing a talk that Chad and I did together, and I'll be cribbing the best stuff that Chad said and cutting out the worst stuff that we both said. So it should be one heck of a talk.
Very diplomatic of you, Chris.
It should be one heck of a talk, because I did it in York. It went very well. So come see me, please. Turn out, because I just want to meet people, especially Manchester folks.
Cool. Oh, the Lovecraft Anthology Volume 1 is out in the States now.
Oh.
It's got a different cover than the British release did.
Right. I saw you put that up on our Facebook page.
It's here, and you can get it, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. Good Dunwich Horror adaptation that Ian Colbard illustrated.
Oh, it's great.
And then the Volume 2 will be out in the States, I think, in October.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in the UK, you're lucky, because you got to go buy it, and you got to meet Mr. Lackey.
So, yahoo!
Do it. And I think that's about all we have. I want to thank Mike Mann, as always, for providing the excellent tech support and keeping our site running.
And I want to thank our reader, Agnes Connaughton, for doing a great job and being the woman I know as Granny.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm so glad we got her on the show. That's such a good idea.
Her birthday is coming up in July. She's going to be 90 years old.
Nice! And what is she going to do for her birthday?
We're having a big shindig over close to where she stays. So it'll be a good time.
Be like an all-night Studio 54 style kind of.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Donna Summers is going to be there.
Yeah.
It's going to be crazy. We'll have blow pumped in through the air conditioning system.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all we have for this week. Hey, Chris, I want to wish you a happy birthday. The day that we're recording, and tomorrow's
thank you.
Birthday.
It is.
Happy birthday, buddy.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back next week. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
And this has been the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.
Wonderful.
Great. What?
What?